Lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of Put Me in Coach, a podcast about the great sport of baseball. My name is Matt Coggins.
And my name is Carl Mizell. How are you today, Matt Coggins?
I am great. We had some snow in New York, so that was kind of fun. Totally unrelated to baseball, but Jon Stewart has come back to The Daily Show.
Yes.
It makes me so happy to see him do that. So that was the highlight of my day, I think. How about you? What you been up to?
Oh, well, like I was telling you before I hit record, I've got a broken tooth, which is fun. So I've got a piece of plastic. I'm going to show the camera. Big white gob back there to keep the jagged edge from dragging along my my tongue. I'm very excited. I try not to mix podcasts, but I reached out for my other podcast with my wife. We are going to start making some stickers, and I reached out to my favorite sticker artist, and I was like, "Hey, are you available for this kind of thing?" She said, "Yes." "What is your idea?" I told her, and she was like, "Hell yes!" So one of my favorite artists is going to be creating a couple of stickers for our other podcast, and that's the big excitement around here. Tigers tickets go on sale tomorrow. Single game tickets go on sale tomorrow. I got an insider code, and I could have gotten them a day early. I wanted to go to opening day, but I can't because I have a work engagement in fucking Ohio that weekend. And not just Ohio, Columbus. Yeah. So I'll moon Ryan Day if I see him while I'm down there.
Thank God. Yeah. He doesn't. I'm sure that man does not live in Ohio 90% of the year.
Oh, probably not. Not at all.
I wanted to give some shout outs up top. For one, this episode today, our main topic, we're going to talk about spring training. Carl has prepared a fantastic script about what it is, where it comes from, the history, the makings of it, and you know, why it's important to this sport. Because it is starting now. We're seeing, if you follow any of your favorite teams on social media, they're showing up. A lot of them ahead of time, which is really fun to see. So that's the main topic of the day. I wanted to give some shout outs up top, just some baseball stuff that I've been noticing. Found a new podcast. It's not new to me, I should say. It's called Days of Roar from the Detroit Free Press. Evan Petzold, who's the Free Press's Tigers beat writer, is one of the hosts on it. Great podcast. I thought it was really fun and engaging and well produced. The co-host with Evan Petzold, I didn't get his name, but he has a heavy Michigan accent, and it made me be like, I don't think Carl and I have that heavy accents being Michigan natives, but no. Now I'm a little self-conscious about it.
Oh, yeah, no, I totally. I lived in Boston when I was a teenager, and they used to make fun of my accent, and I was like, do you hear yourself right now? And I mean, I understand that we do have an accent from time to time. I, for a long time, sounded Canadian, and people thought I was from Canada. I still do sometimes have a slight O in my sorry. I will sort of slip into a sorry, but otherwise, no. I feel like, I attribute it to our theater backgrounds.
Yeah.
Probably got trained out of us to have a regional non-specific dialect or tone.
I definitely, I've listened back to some of my older podcasts and noticed like there's a moment right when I was in college where I was clearly paying very close attention to what my voice sounded like. And then a couple years afterward where it just fell off and I went full Michigan. And now I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I don't know. But I'm definitely very self-conscious about it.
Oh, absolutely.
The other thing I wanted to share was I got added on Twitter to a big group chat that's all kind of like people who are cool in the Tigers fandom. And I was a little flattered to be considered part of Tigers online fandom and have a reputation as being cool. It was all, you know, kind of on the more progressive side people. I think this kind of had a little bit of reaction to the Trevor Bauer news of the week, which we're not really going to dive into because fuck that guy. Yes. But I wanted to give a shout out to Griff at Deep to Center on Twitter and YouTube. He does some cool YouTube videos about the Tigers. He arranged all that. Seems like a cool guy, a great follow, and a good Tigers fan. You love to see him out there.
Oh, damn. Am I going to have to go back to Twitter?
I wouldn't. Now would be a bad time to rejoin. If you're already on it, you might as well enjoy it. But
I have an account. I just never, ever use it. Yeah. But I would use it expressly. Like, if it was an avenue for that one specific thing, I would. I mean, that's functionally why I keep Reddit around, is to track baseball and tell people in the Tigers subreddit why it's a terrible idea to sign Matt Chapman.
Yeah. Why? But somebody was like, we should get him on a one-year deal. And I'm like, are you fucking insane?
I love when people say it so definitively, like, just sign, just put a gun to his head and make him sign the deal. Make real life like MLB The Show, where if you just make the numbers big enough and make that green bar go up, he'll sign here. He'll have no choice because he doesn't have free will.
We could get Shohei Ohtani. We just offer him, like, I don't know, $30 million for a year. He'll sign with us. No. Idiots.
Wait, all right. Sign him. Anyway.
Let's get to the baseball news. I thought this was a funny bit of news to kick off. Players are starting to show up to spring training, and they are receiving for the first time the brand new Nike jerseys. Nike took over all baseball jerseys a couple years ago, but this is their first big moment where they get to kind of have full control over design and aesthetic of the jerseys. They partnered with online retailer Fanatics. They changed little elements, like the nameplate is small. The number placement on some of the fronts is different. I'm wearing this black Mets jersey right now.
Looks great.
This is an old one, right? It's actually a bootleg. But this part, the Mets logo, smaller. The number on the front, different placement. They're splitting it differently in the middle. Little things that they think will make more comfortable for the players. But the players that have showed up are like, this sucks. It feels cheap. It feels like plastic almost. Miles Mikolas was one of the people that really went out and kind of made a statement. I was like, this fucking sucks.
Keep them pants, away from Chris Sale.
Yeah. The pants don't fit. The fabric is very different. They look and feel cheap. It's a new model called the Vapor Premier. And I thought it was really funny because almost immediately after this news story goes out, a press release goes out from Nike saying, we're so happy to be debuting our new jerseys. And Jason Hayward from the Dodgers, who I think I'm going to put this clip as the stinger for the episode.
This feels even more authentic than the ones that we've been wearing, to be honest. Like, the material feels that much nicer. Feels like it's going to breathe better. And I think the really cool part for the fans, the numbers on the back having that different texture.
Like, you could kind of tell that whoever had phone in one hand had gun in the other.
Exactly.
Come on, Jason, say it. See how much I love this jersey.
Look like Malcolm McDowell in A Clockwork Orange.
They do look like shit, though. Like, the names especially.
They look god-awful. Fuck Fanatics, man. I'm so god. They're just the worst. They're the worst. And honestly, as far as I'm concerned, even if he had nothing to do with this, I still think this is the worst thing Rob Manfred did in his tenure.
He keeps one-upping himself.
Even if this isn't his fault. It happened on your watch, Rob.
In other news, MLB has placed former Mets GM Billy Epler on its ineligible list through the end of the 2024 World Series following results of the league's investigation into Epler's misuse of the injured list. This came out around the time, end of last season, when he got fired by the Mets, that he was under investigation for manipulating the injured list, basically putting guys on who were not injured, but in a effort to make more roster space and kind of clean up guys that didn't have any minor league options yet. It says that a handful of players that were interviewed about MLB's investigation agreed every team does it, as in they fabricate injuries, and they were both interested and confused as to why the league was only scrutinizing one team's GM. And that was from Disha Thosar from Fox Sports. Seems to be, and they were interviewing Mets players too, Mets players that might have been victim of this, who were like, I didn't think it was that weird. Every team does this.
Well, and they do, but I think Ken Rosenthal made a good point about it, which was it was definitely Billy Epler was being used as he was being made an example of. Because, you know, the Apple Watch thing came out. They said, stop cheating. They didn't, you know, that sort of thing. So by a lot of insiders' readings of the situation, he was just being made an example of because you should know by now.
What was the Apple Watch thing?
Apple Watch was, I think, was what Boston was doing. That was how Boston was cheating. Like, they were using Apple Watches, like Alex Cora. Like, I can't remember the timeline of all the cheating because there was the Yankees memo and then there was the Apple Watch incidents or cheating with the Red Sox, and there was a memo released and it didn't seem to do any good, so they punished the Astros. So now they're just basically, the consensus is that this is just him being made an example of, so hopefully other people don't do this, because yeah, sure, everybody does it, but that doesn't make it right.
Yeah, don't do it again. Yeah,
exactly.
I get it. Speaking of don't do it again or ever, don't do it at all. The mayor of Las Vegas says that the Oakland Athletics should stay in Oakland amidst chaos in their move. Just this week, it's come out that all of this bullshit is happening. Currently, John Fisher has provided zero clarity on where his portion of the funds for the new stadium is coming from. We talked about this before, but he seems to be counting on a lot of state money, city money. The Nevada State Education Association has filed a lawsuit that would block public funding. There are no renderings for the new park. There was like a mock-up, if you will, that I'm sure an illustrator did, but there's no like fundamental ground plan for how you're using the land, and they don't even exactly know how much land they're going to use. But the Tropicana Casino has announced their closing date because they're still moving forward with demolishing that building. And I think most importantly, the team doesn't know where they're going to play after this season. They're still in the Coliseum this year, but after this year, they don't know what's happening. What the fuck?
Yeah, it's I mean, this is well-trodden territory. You don't need a couple of schmucks with a podcast to tell you how crazy all of this is. The thing that is still driving me the craziest, and the thing that I think is most hilarious about all this, is that the site that they're supposed to be building on in Vegas is 9 acres. An acre is roughly like 43-ish thousand feet. So even if you said 400,000 square feet of land for a big fucking stadium. The original plans in Oakland were for the parcel that they originally, like, I think it was the Howard Terminal, was supposed to be 55 acres by comparison. And that wasn't good enough. So it was never about wanting to stay in Oakland. It was clearly wanting to go to Las Vegas. But this is just the biggest clown car. It's just, instead of clowns getting out of the car, it's just John Fisher over and over again, tripping and falling and getting back in the car, trying it again.
Simpsons gag where Sideshow Bob keeps stepping on rake after rake.
Exactly. He's Sideshow Bobbing his way through this.
I'm confused why the owners unanimously voted to approve this if there's no real concrete plan for the move. All it is really is, we're moving.
Yep.
That's not a plan. And if I'm an owner who has financial stake in this move, why would you approve it? At least not with more clarification saying, hey, John, you know, I'm an evil billionaire. I totally get it. Do whatever you want. But I would like to know how you're doing it before we say that you can. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, I mean, you would think, but it's an old boys club kind of thing where, hey, I'll blindly support you if you blindly support me down the line. I mean, they only care about themselves. That's it. That's why they did it. Because hopefully when they want to fuck over the community, the other 29 owners will be there to support them.
Very true. Very true. All right, we got time for one more. Do you want the Netflix story or the Corey Kluber story?
I want to talk Kluber.
Let's talk Kluber. Corey Kluber, he is the only two-time Cy Young winner in Cleveland sports history. He has retired after 13 seasons. He leaves the game with a career line of 34 WAR, 3.44 ERA, 1,641 innings pitched, 1,725 strikeouts, one save. That was from last season on June 21st. He pitched for the Red Sox, allowed 4 runs on 5 hits in the final 3 innings of a 10-4 win. I mean, to get a save before you retire, that's pretty fun.
Absolutely. He is one of my favorite players, even though he spent a lot of his time in Cleveland destroying the Tigers.
Ohio.
I know. I know, but Clubot, and apparently he did not like the nickname Clubot. a couple of weeks ago, I made this 5-minute TikTok about how the Hall of Fame is going to become like The Good Place, the NBC hit show The Good Place, and basically saying we're going to have to reframe how we look at who goes into the Hall of Fame. Corey Kluber is going to be one of the exhibit A's in this conversation, because when at his most dominant, there was nobody else like Kluber, but he was so dominant in such a small frame. And I was trying to use Stathead. Unfortunately, Stathead can't really pull this, but there aren't many guys in the Hall of Fame. Or there aren't many guys with two Cy Youngs who aren't in the Hall of Fame. Basically, everybody with three Cy Youngs is in the Hall of Fame.
I think it's already punched.
What's that?
The ticket's already punched if you got that three. You get exactly. That third Cy Young, you're like, I'm in.
Exactly. So I think he's going to be a great test case down the line. You know, if he stays on, you know, gets the 5% and stays on the ballot, I think he's going to be one of these guys. I think you're going to start to see those vote gaps or those vote pickups every year get bigger and bigger for a lot of guys like him. So instead of gaining like 5 to 7% every year, they're gaining like 12 to 15% or more, because people are just starting to have a better understanding of the fact that, like, look, if we don't change the way we think about this, nobody's going in for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, as we stand right now, you've got your Verlanders, your Scherzers, your Kershaws.
Yep.
Greinke may have retired in the most Greinke way where nobody really cares. But that's it, right? And so now you got this next generation of guys like Corey Kluber or like Blake Snell, who's like not mind-blowing, but Blake Snell is two Cy Youngs.
Yep.
I think probably a Hall of Famer, especially considering he's still got time left in him, you know? But I think you're totally right. I think that the day and age of the superstar, lights out, amazing Verlander type is probably behind us.
Oh, yeah.
Because of how we use starting pitchers. How many of them even go 6 innings nowadays, especially not 7 innings? I totally agree. It's something that needs to be rethought. And I think Corey Kluber, as much as I hate to admit it, good pitcher. All righty. Let's move on to the main story of the week. Spring training. Carl, take it away.
Thank you. Now, before I get started, I want to preface everything I'm about to say by saying, remember, we are talking about things that happened over 100 years ago. So there is a lot of conflicting information about what is out there. Like, for example, I'm going to mention that apparently the Detroit Tigers are credited as being the first team to ever hold a spring training in the state of Arizona. But then I also saw something that said that the Yankees did it in Arizona as well. But the time that it happened was murky, and it was kind of implied that it might have been before the Tigers. So I did the absolute best that I could to verify the veracity of all these claims.
Yeah.
So please keep that in mind. Now,
I learned that during... when we did the Cleveland Spiders episode, it's like there's some shit that is just mentioned in news clippings. It, like, I think I was trying to trace when they started being called the Indians. They were getting called the Indians back in the late 1800s.
Yep.
Never knew why. There weren't any Indian or, you know, Native Americans on the team before then. So, like, where did that come from? And no one really talks about it either. So it's just one of those things, like, I got confused by, and let alone, like, little details, big details, you know?
Baseball is a sport full of apocryphal tales. And yeah. I think I'm going to be telling you a couple of them today. For decades, baseball fans have had the second week in February circled in the calendar of their brains, along with what I think are the four greatest words in the English language: pitchers and catchers report. I am, of course, talking about quite possibly baseball's greatest tradition, spring training. Now, I've had the good fortune to attend a couple of spring training games in recent years, and there really isn't anything quite like it, in my opinion. Last year, I got to take my family down to Florida for vacation, and my father-in-law and I took my 5-year-old son to his first spring training game. And even though he had already been to a couple of minor league games, the Pirates-Yankees spring training game that we took him to completely blew his little mind. A 12-year-old gifted him a ball that he had caught during warm-ups, unprompted. He just walked up to him and gave it to him. He got to share a hot dog with his granddad, and then strangers around us started giving him peanuts because A, they're delicious, and B, after he'd eat one, he would ceremoniously jump up and down on the shells to the delight of all the snowbirds around us. They just were like, here, eat a peanut. He'd munch it, step on it, they'd cheer. It was adorable. He's just shy of six this year, so it's hard to tell if the baseball bug's bite is going to have any lasting effects, but it cannot be denied that for those 117 minutes, thank you, pitch clock, he was in baseball heaven, and so was I. So this week on Put Me In Coach, we are going to be talking all things spring training, its history, its purpose, and how it evolved from a glorified team-building exercise to a baseball institution. Now, have you had the opportunity to go to a spring training game yet?
No. Unfortunately, I mean, I've been to Florida a handful of times, but I guess the closest that I'd even come close. No, I don't even know where in relation like Lakeland or Port St. Lucie are to where my family lives in like Fort Lauderdale area. I don't really know Florida that well.
Yeah, I don't.
I don't like it.
Well, don't. In that case, you're going to love some of the things that I typed into the script later. Like any other tale from history, there is some debate about the origins of spring training. A popular origin story credits Chicago White Stockings, now the Cubs, first baseman slash manager Cap Anson with being the first to take his team south, specifically to Hot Springs, Arkansas, which early in the era of spring training became sort of like the first ground zero for spring training. There was actually MLB channel documentary about Hot Springs. I've never seen it, but it apparently exists. But he took him to Hot Springs, Arkansas for spring training in 1886, but other credible stories dispute that idea. Newspaper reports from 1869 tell us that William Boss Tweed sent his New York Mutuals to New Orleans prior to that season, predating Anson by 17 years.
Tweed owned a baseball team?
I know, right? Boss Tweed.
What?
Right? It's so perfect. So that happened 17 years before Anson did this. And what likely led to Anson getting the credit is a surprisingly prescient idea. He took along a reporter to document the trip in the hopes of improving attendance. Now, whether or not it worked is unclear, but what is clear is that Cap Anson never missed an opportunity to be one of the most vile racists the game has ever known, which, when we're talking about baseball, is depressingly impressive. Seriously, as a side note, if you have a Wikipedia page and you have a section in your Wikipedia page that is labeled racial intolerance.
Oh, no.
Like Cap Anson does.
Oh, no.
You probably were a piece of shit.
Probably.
Yeah, probably. He was such a piece of shit that other people back in that time were like, you're being a bit much.
Yeah, all the people that are like totally cool with separate drinking fountains and restrooms, like, this guy's a racist.
Yeah, this guy's a real piece of work. I could go on about that, but I won't. Now, if you've paid attention at all to the nature of baseball and those who appreciate it, it should come as no surprise to you that many folks involved in the game hated the idea of spring training and could not see the benefits of making such a trip. Even in its earliest days, baseball men were already in love with the idea of hating change and being stuck in their ways. Now, when Anson's White Stockings won two championships in the first 2 years that he took his team south, those same baseball men quickly changed their tune and started dragging their teams across the country in the hopes of recreating his success. The problem with that idea is that no one really knew what the hell they were doing. When Boss Tweed took the Mutuals to New Orleans, there was no real training to speak of. Instead, the Mutuals just went to New Orleans and then barnstormed their way back north until the regular season started. That was it. Even teams that tried to get actual training in did so in rather primitive ways. In his book, Under the March Sun, The Story of Spring Training, author Charles Fountain said of these early spring trainings, quote, though there was some throwing and some hitting, much of spring training in those years was given over to long morning hikes of 2 to 7 miles, medicine ball and Indian club workouts, an Indian club is something akin to a weighted bat, with maybe some hot baths thrown in to boil out those alcoholic microbes. Close quote.
I mean, it's better than nothing. Like, I guess it's better than sitting in cold New York for a couple of months. Like, at least you're getting your body warm. You're seeing the sun. You're getting some vitamin D.
Yep, exactly.
I guess detoxing a little bit. A little bit.
Yeah, I reading the Hannes Wagner biography, and apparently he was a big basketball fan. And so, like, he started playing basketball in the off season to stay in shape before the advent of spring training. And again, back in, like, I think it was like 1901, 1902, the Pirates started going to hot springs like everybody else.
Yeah. You think about, too, how many baseball players love golf.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that is the ultimate, like, not quite a sport, but still a sport that baseball players embrace a lot because there's a lot of similar mechanics, but less body intensive.
Yeah, absolutely. Another leap forward in the training portion of spring training happened sometime in the 1890s when Baltimore Orioles manager Ned Hanlon began taking his team to Macon, Georgia, and running them through 8 weeks of 8-hour days filled with drills that mimicked in-game situations. So not only did he just escalate, like, he took it so much further, but now we see what most people consider to be the first example of, like, actual sport-specific training. They would practice double steals, hit and runs, squeeze plays, and driving the ball straight into the dirt when the defense was playing deep, a strategy that became so synonymous with those Oriole teams that it became known as the Baltimore Chop. Sometimes you'll still hear the odd broadcaster, refer to that if somebody hits one of those, like, those damn ground balls that hits, like, right off home plate, goes up in the air, and
so get, like, a swinging bunt almost, like,
yeah, like they're aggressively trying to deliberately slam it, you know, down into the ground, which is something that has been done time and time again. Like, they'll do that. Maury Wills used to love doing that. So they would not, when Maury Wills was playing, they would not water the dirt right around home plate, so that it would be a little bit more firm so he could really chop that ball and try and outrun those. Conversely, other teams, when he would play on the road, would soak it. So so he couldn't get out of there. And apparently Whitey Herzog, who managed the Cardinals in the 80s, when they would paint the lines on the artificial turf at Busch Stadium, he would try and get them to paint them a little wider because he had some speedsters that would like to drop bunts, and so every little inch would try to help him out there. Let's see. Much like Anson's Chicago club, the Orioles reeled off three consecutive championships in the first three seasons he took his team south. Hanlon's success served as a major factor in owners league-wide understanding that a structured and specialized spring training could go a long way towards fielding a winner. New York Giants managerial legend John McGraw took the lessons of Anson and Hanlon to heart, but he took things a step further by blending their strategies. Not only did he put his team through similarly lengthy practices like Hanlon did, but he also leaned into the promotional aspects that Anson developed. After the Giants won the World Series in 1905, McGraw moved his club from a training site in rather rural Savannah, Georgia, to the more metropolitan Nashville, Tennessee. He put his players up in a swanky hotel, and then he arranged for his players to be transported to and from their training site in carriages, festooned with embroidered blankets that let everybody know who was in said carriages was, quote, world champions. He also made sure that any reporter he crossed paths with would hear his guarantees of a New York repeat in 1906. They did not manage to pull off the repeat, but McGraw didn't care. He wanted butts in the seats to see his well-trained squad.
Hell yeah.
Now, astute listeners might have noticed that we have not mentioned two states yet, Florida and Arizona. Well, we have technically mentioned Florida, but not in the context of this piece, right?
Just to trash on them.
Just to trash on them. And don't worry, if you hate Florida, this is the episode for you.
Hell yeah.
I just take a couple pot shots at them. It's fun. And the reason we've yet to discuss the now permanent homes of spring training is because it took a while for them to become the baseball destinations that they are today. The Washington Nationals, not the iteration that we currently know them as, are credited with being the first team to train in Florida in 1888. And the Tigers are credited for being the first team to head to Arizona, but not until 1929. And like I mentioned earlier, I did find some information that said the Yankees might have preceded them in Arizona, but there's nothing concrete about that.
Who knows?
Yeah, but neither place took hold right away. I had so much fun typing this next portion. After spending 3 weeks in Jacksonville, Florida, the Nationals slunk to a 48-86 record, which was enough to put the other teams off the state until 1903, when venerable Connie Mack and his Philadelphia Athletics became the first team to spend an entire spring training season in Florida. Like the Nationals, they opted for Jacksonville, and like most people who go to Jacksonville, they regretted it almost immediately. Between the general Florida-ness of it all and the fact that, much like the Nationals, they finished the subsequent season 14 and a half games out of first place, chief among Connie Mack's problems was one Rube Waddell, who Jason Mendoza'd his way through Jacksonville, Florida at one point, wrestling an alligator and then attempting to take his own life after he was spurned by a local woman he'd apparently tried to add to his collection of wives. The A's would not return to Florida for 11 years.
Pretty tame Rube Waddell story right there.
Oh yeah, and I'm sure there's more. But goddamn, I love a good Rube Waddell story.
We will never tell Rube stories on this podcast because I think the dollop pretty much killed it, and so look out for the dollop's Rube Waddell episode. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, I honestly, quite frankly, if you're up for it and if you feel like doing it, I would link it into the show notes of this episode. Just for they don't need our help. If anything, we could, you know, shag a few of their foul tips and bring some listeners on, but goddamn, they did such a great job.
I don't think that's the only time Rube Waddell was caught wrestling an alligator. I'll just
probably
say
not
that.
No, probably not. February of 1913 marks the true beginning of spring training in Florida. The Chicago Cubs, lured to Tampa by the promise of having the team's expenses covered up to $100 per player by the city's mayor, became the first team to convene in the Tampa area. The following year, several other teams made camp in the state. The A's finally returned to Jacksonville, the St. Louis Browns went to St. Petersburg, and the Cardinals settled in St. Augustine. And this group functionally formed the earliest iteration of what we now call the Grapefruit League. There you go, right? Pretty neat. If I do say
they grow grapefruits in Florida?
I don't know, but
I know it's an orange state. They're known for their oranges.
Well,
anyway, move on.
Don't worry. Don't worry. You're jumping ahead.
Okay.
You're jumping ahead, big fella. like most things that try to grow in the desert, baseball took a little bit longer to take hold in Arizona. The Tigers only trained there for one season in 1929 before heading to California in 1930, and it would be 17 years before anyone else gave it a shot. Now, in the midst of my research, I was completely unsurprised to learn that the man responsible for taking on such a monumental task was Bill Veeck, a man known for taking wild shots, making some work while others failed spectacularly. At the time, Veeck owned the Cleveland Indians, now known as the Guardians, but prior to that, he had owned the Milwaukee Brewers, who were a minor league club at that time. And he had them conducting their spring training in Ocala, Florida. That all changed after he inadvertently sat in a section reserved for black fans and was immediately approached by a sheriff's deputy telling him to leave. Never one for half measures, Veeck didn't just leave the section, he left the goddamn state. He would go on to buy the Cleveland Indians, and with baseball's color barrier set to crumble soon, the move turned out to be prescient. Not long after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier, Veeck would sign Larry Doby, the first black player to suit up for an American League team. Veeck managed to convince Horace Stoneham, who owned the New York Giants, to move his club's spring training to Tucson, Arizona, which wasn't too big of an ask for Stoneham, because Stoneham had business ventures and a winter home nearby, and he was also a fan of the hot springs at nearby Buckhorn Cottages. And I've got a link in here that I encourage you folks to go take a look at, because there is a ton of information that I left out of this episode about these amazing hot springs in Tucson, Arizona, and how all the teams that trained around the area would come there and soak in these hot springs. And it was also, Tucson was a pretty progressive city at the time. So the black players that would come down there, black, white, it didn't matter. If you were at the Buckhorn Cottages, it didn't matter. So a lot of players congregated there.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody's friends when you're doing a soak.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to be the old guy who sits completely naked in saunas and makes everyone uncomfortable.
I don't know about that. Maybe when we get older.
Yeah,
we'll get rid of any kind of reservations once we get older.
I'm 10 years older than you, I think, so I'm already well ahead of you. I always forget how old you are. You're ageless to me.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, no, it's a good thing. His Giants would remain in Stoneham's Giants would remain in Arizona for 25 years, and he credited those hot springs for helping his Giants win the World Series in 1954. The Cubs followed suit in 1951 and moved to Arizona, and then the Orioles went west in 1954, thus forming a nascent Cactus League.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That one makes a little more sense.
It does. But again, you're jumping ahead.
I'm being patient.
don't worry. I'm gonna tell you right now, there is going to be a lot of room for digression, and maybe if we want to double back and talk about some news, because I could have made this script wildly dense, but it was all just like, and then this team showed up and played at this stadium until this year, and then they moved over here. Like, it was a lot of that stuff, so I just kind of left all that out.
I'd want to learn more about these young men doing a soak in the saunas here.
Oh, yeah. And the article that I linked, the family that owned it, they had all these pictures on the wall of, like, Juan Marichal and Willie Mays, like, getting rub downs in the sauna. And they, like, so there's pictures of Willie Mays getting a rub down from somebody. And then he, like, signed it, like, thanks for the springs. I'm awesome because of you, Willie Mays.
Hell yeah.
He's just getting, like, that thing where, like, he's got an arm out and he's just kind of sitting there. And the trainer's got, like, one arm under, like, the arms underneath it, and he's just, like, rubbing them down, like, indiscriminately. You don't know what it's actually doing, if it means anything. It just feels nice to be touched.
Must have worked. I mean, he was Willie Mays.
I was going to say, he is Willie fucking Mays, after all. A wrench got thrown into the institution of spring training with America's entry into World War II. Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis, whom we have mentioned many times on this show, not in a flattering way, issued an edict preventing teams from traveling too far from their home cities as to not add stress to the nation's infrastructure during wartime, because they needed the rails clear and the roads, you know, whatever was being transported, I think it was all pretty much rail at that time, and they needed to transport equipment, not baseball players. So teams began training in what we would consider non-traditional locations, like French Lick, Indiana. The Cubs and the White Sox trained there. Terre Haute, Indiana, the White Sox. College Park, Maryland, the Washington Senators. And Asbury Park, New Jersey, the Yankees, naturally. Home, birthplace of the boss.
The right? Boss. The boss. The boss.
Yep. Never miss an opportunity to reference the boss on the show. Landis lifted the restriction, clearing the way for teams to return to the South, which also cleared the way for Branch Rickey, who was the president, general manager, and co-owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers. It allowed him to buy a whole-ass decommissioned naval base in Vero Beach, Florida, and turn it into what we now know as Dodger Town.
Cool.
Yeah.
So that's still around today, Dodger Town?
Yeah. Now, I know the Dodgers have got, like, complexes all over the place, but Vero Beach, where Dodger Town is still there. I don't know if they still use it. I think they actually train in Camelback Ranch in Arizona.
Okay.
These days, but Dodger Town, I think they still use it as like a training site.
Complex
maybe
league.
Exactly, because that was a big thing that Branch Rickey instituted. Why he instituted Dodger Town and would have like hundreds of players there, because he wanted every player in the Dodgers pipeline to be trained the Dodger way.
Mm.
So he was one of the first people, if not the first person, to create sort of an idea of uniform training across all levels of baseball. And he did it.
That's sick.
With Dodger. It is very fucking sick.
As Terre Haute, Indiana.
Hell of a lot better than Terre Haute. I've been there. Nothing. Nice town. It's just not. I'm just saying. It's just not, you know, you don't have the nice all year weather. But still, I would pick Terre Haute over Florida.
Yeah.
As the league started to expand, teams had to make a choice. I know that was really wishy-washy there. Teams had to make a choice between Arizona and Florida. The Angels and the Colt 45s. AKA the Astros, opted to join stake their camp in Arizona when they joined the league, bringing the number of teams in Arizona to 6. They would eventually be joined by the San Diego Padres, the Seattle Pilots, more on them in a second, and the Oakland A's, still owned by Connie Mack. Now, in 1970, the Seattle Pilots showed up in Arizona only to have their owner declare bankruptcy. They were sold to former Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, who renamed them the Brewers and shuttled them off to Milwaukee, making them the only team to change names and locations during spring training. At one point, all of their gear was stored away somewhere in Provo, Utah, until they knew where that gear needed to be shipped. They were like, Seattle? Milwaukee?
Now, one second. Pause real quick on this thought, though, because they have all this gear, right, and waiting for them to go to spring training or waiting to come back from spring training?
I think that's what it was. I'm guessing it was like spring training was completed because it got down to like 31 days before the start of the season. And they're like, come on, guys, what the hell are we doing here?
Did it still say Seattle across the front? I know they had the same colors, but like.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't tell you. There was not any information that either A, I found, or B, worked hard enough to find. But considering that we're recording this a day late because I let all of last week get away from me, it's probably the latter.
Oh, good.
That's fine. By 1989, there were 8 teams training in Arizona, and the other 18 teams trained in Florida because, again, this is pre-expansion. Or pre the most recent expansion. Mm-hmm. By 2018, the now 30-team league was evenly split with 15 teams each in Arizona and Florida. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't put a bow on all of this by covering the origin of the name Cactus League and Grapefruit.
So
let's start with the easy one. Let's get this out of the way. A lot of desert in Arizona, a lot of cacti in the desert.
Huh.
That's it. As far as anybody can tell. That's it. Everybody was like, it was basically like you type that into a search and it's that one meme of that older gentleman in the red shirt just kind of shrugging.
Yeah. And next you're going to tell me they have their team, the Diamondbacks, because there's a lot of snakes in Arizona as well.
I am going to tell you that. But I'm also going to. Yeah. But I'm also going to tell you, do you know what their mascot is?
A snake?
No, their mascot, like that actually wanders the ballpark.
Oh, no. Wait, what is it?
It's a bobcat.
Oh, right. Which we covered this before. It's because the guy's name was Bob, or the arena's name was the Bob, or something like
that. That's right. Yeah. So the story goes that one of the early executives of the Arizona Diamondbacks had a 6-year-old or 7-year-old son or a small child who pointed out that the Bank One Ballpark, B-O-B, spelled Bob, and so that's how it came to be. And that's people like we. Folks, some folks in Detroit call Comerica Park the Copa. It didn't really catch. Not a lot of people call it that. But some people do call that stadium the Bob.
Interesting.
So, there you go.
Interesting.
It's way more interesting than how they named the Cactus League, as far as I'm concerned. Now, as for the Grapefruit League, that is a different, albeit apocryphal, story. Now, according to legend, the name stems from a publicity stunt gone awry. In 1915, an aviator named Ruth Law was tasked with dropping 500 golf balls onto a local golf course as part of a promotion. The Dodgers were training nearby. Some of the players caught wind of this, and they convinced her to come to Dodgertown to recreate the stunt. It was pre-Dodgertown, but like their training site. You get what I'm saying. But instead of dropping golf balls, they were going to have her go up about 500 feet and drop a baseball, just one baseball, and have somebody try to catch it. Their manager at the time, Wilbert Robinson, volunteered. But when Ruth Law went up to go do this, she missed one important piece of the puzzle, a baseball. So instead, she reached into the lunchbox of a ground crew member, pulled out a grapefruit, and just launched it out of the aircraft. It goes hurtling down towards Robinson. He fails to catch it, taking the grapefruit right on the chest. The impact resulted in a massive spray of grapefruit juice, which combined with the pain of being hit by a grapefruit approaching terminal velocity, convinced him that his chest had literally exploded from the impact. It had not, but it did allegedly inspire the name Grapefruit League.
That's awesome. I've heard that story before. I had no idea it was connected to the Grapefruit League.
That's apparently it. So
why didn't you get an outfielder to catch it? Out of all the people that catch, if it was going to be a baseball hurtling towards the earth at terminal velocity, why wouldn't you have somebody that could catch the ball?
I don't know.
And then it was a grapefruit, so this could have killed somebody.
Yeah. Now, 500 feet is not an insignificant amount of distance, and I don't know how quickly something can reach terminal velocity, which is like 9.81 meters per second or something like that. So convert that into feet. I don't.
Told you before.
Yep.
Math guy.
I would like to take this opportunity to try to convince America to go back or to try the metric system again. It's so much easier, you guys. But yeah, I don't know why they didn't have an actual, like, I assume somebody named Wilbert Robinson, who was coaching a baseball team, was not a spry young man.
No.
Probably a bit
past 1915.
In 1915. Yeah. Probably half blind. Probably can't see, you know, the glove in front of his face. I just love the idea of watching an old guy, you know, trying to pick up, you know, trying to pick it up, you know, trying to track it. And then he gets it. He gets it. He gets it. He's lucky he didn't get him in the goddamn face.
Yeah. Am I dead?
Yeah. We would be having an entirely different conversation. He would be in the same conversation as Ray Chapman. Rest in peace, Ray Chapman.
A much dumber reason.
For a way dumber reason. Much dumber. How did Ray Chapman die? He died on the field getting hit, unfortunately, by Carl May. Exactly.
Yeah.
By accident.
This is a fucking dropping a baseball or grapefruit out of a plane.
And could you imagine being somebody in 1915 when they really haven't perfected science? And you're off to the side and you see, like, maybe you're from behind and you just see a spray.
Yeah.
You hear a sound of a grapefruit exploding, but you don't know if it's the guy's skull, his face.
It had to have been loud.
Oh, God. Yes. And he thinks that a chest burster came, you know, bursting out of his chest.
What a beautiful moment in time where we had airplanes.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that were like, oh my God, we should do something fun with this, but no real scientific forethought of, like, what you can drop out of an airplane. They would never do this today.
And this is not that long after we, like, nailed flight.
Yeah.
Like, this is 1915. I'm pretty sure the Wright brothers were still alive, and I'm pretty sure that when the Wright brothers were trying to figure out flight, they did not have this shit in mind, which means that they were not the forward thinkers that we like to think they are. What if we invented a way to go way up in the high and way up high in the sky and just drop shit on each other and see who can catch it?
I mean, I kind of want to see it now.
Yeah.
They should take a drone up 500 feet, drop the ball, see if Brandon Nimmo or Buck Showalter should catch it to make it more apt to this story.
No, you know who should do it? Trevor Bauer should do it. He's not doing anything else. He should take one of his shitty drones and he should fly it up in the sky and then try and catch a baseball. That would impress me. It would be the only thing he's done that would impress me. I guess what I'm trying to say is fuck Trevor Bauer. I never miss an opportunity to say that. Can we just change the name of the show to that?
This is the Fuck Trevor Bauer Show. Yeah, man, that's spring training. I guess my biggest question that will probably go unanswered. We have the Dodgers, the Angels, the Giants, the A's, the Diamondbacks, and I'm probably forgetting something. A handful of teams that all play in fair weather year-round.
Yeah.
Why do they go to California and Arizona? Or I'm sorry, Florida and Arizona.
Well, left a lot of stuff out. But what I would have to assume is that it's because a lot of folks or a lot of teams have developed around their spring training sites, especially with the rise in analytics and biomechanics and all that sort of thing. Now they can go, they can have this spot where it's there year round. So, you know, you might be a cold weather team, but if you've got some minor leaguers that you want to bring up and run them through some major league paces, you know, the Tigers, you know, can send them to Lakeland, so they might be up, they might be in Lakeland in March or April kind of thing. Guys might stick around after spring training to get a little extra work in before coming north with the team if they're on the injured list. So I would say it's probably more, it has to do with the fact that teams are hunkery, like teams have off, like complexes in the Dominican now, like they're setting up, you know, little camps in encampments all over the place. So that's probably the most likely answer.
Okay. That makes sense to me. I also, it's interesting. I had this thought recently. Last year, or was it 2 years ago, the Tigers were playing their first series at home in the snow. It was actively snowing while they were playing. Great picture of Miguel Cabrera blasting a home run as it's downpouring snow. That's cool and all, but like you wonder about some of these northern teams that play outdoors. And I've never been a big put a dome on a stadium proponent, but I do wonder about the time in which we start the baseball season and the way weather has been so wild in the advent of climate change lately. What's your thoughts on, if you take your team south for spring training, why not start the season somewhere else than home, or play indoors for a certain, like, they could go across the street to Ford Field and play their first month before it gets warm, you know?
Logistics, sure. Money. You know, I mean, that's really what it boils down to, is those two things. It's like when Toronto couldn't, like when Toronto had to stay in Buffalo, like they had to retrofit the AAA stadium in Buffalo to make it major league, you know, like major league quality. If you take a look, if you follow hockey at all, what's going on with the Arizona Coyotes right now, they're playing in a 4,500 seat college arena called Mullet Arena. On the
they
campus.
Are? What the fuck?
Yeah, because they don't have a home, because there's this, all nobody wants the Coyotes. Like, it's this crazy thing. So right now they're playing in a 4,500 seat college stadium that they had to spend a couple million dollars to make it, again, NHL appropriate. That's why you probably would never see that. I mean, the players union wouldn't stand for it, because there's an acceptable level of, you know, facility quality. So that's probably why. I'm of the opinion, going forward, like if you live like if your team is located in a certain area, like if everybody knows that you have shitty weather in the spring and you want to build a new stadium, great, but it has to have a retractable.
Yeah, I agree with that. If you're building it now.
Yeah, if you're building it now, it has to have a retractable roof. That's
White Sox.
Yep.
Looking at you. There's Kansas City looking at you.
Toronto did it over 30 years ago. Like, it's not a novel concept. Like, it's been around for a very long time. And I'm pretty sure there hasn't been a rainout in Toronto in that time.
I did find something funny about Rogers Center that they tweeted out the other day, like a big breaking news thing. It's like, fans, you'll be delighted to know this season, every seat in the arena will have cup holders. And I'm like, wait, awesome. You didn't have that before?
Yeah. I've been to the Rogers Center, and I don't remember. I just had the most Canadian experience I could have ever had. Real quick, it was 2006. It was June of 06. The Tigers were not really convincing people yet. Like, they were playing good, but they hadn't convinced people that they were good. And some Canadians around me realized that I was there rooting for the Tigers. I actually got this baseball tossed up to me from the Tigers dugout, because I was sitting right on top of the Tigers dugout, from Jamie Walker. Cool. So I still have this ball from 18 years ago. And they were harassing me and, you know, giving me a hard time, but playfully in a Canadian way. And they were like, hey, you know, we won some World Series more recently than you did. You know, what do you think about that, Tigers fan? And I was like, hey, when's the last time the Stanley Cup was in Toronto? And they all got real quiet. And one guy just leaned down and gently placed his hand on my shoulder and said, too far.
America, baby.
That's all I got, man. Like I said, it was real hard. I could have fleshed it out with a bunch of, you know, nonsense about where teams started and where teams went, but that's really it. I mean, that's sort of the overall history of it. It started out as, like I said, functionally a glorified, you know, business trip kind of thing, you know, team building exercise, that eventually morphed into what we see a lot these days, which was teams trying to find every little advantage that they could. And when teams saw that it worked, they recreated it, and it became the institution that we know it to be today, which is spring training baseball. And now there are gorgeous parks in Florida and Arizona. I've been to two. I've been to Lacombe Park, where the Pirates play. It's an amazing facility. I've been to Lakeland, where the Tigers play at Joker Marchant. Loved it. It was so great. If you have the opportunity, I know it's not something that everybody has the opportunity to do, and I didn't get to do it until I was in my friggin' 40s. But if you ever get the opportunity to do it, I highly encourage you to do so. It is such an experience. It's not the experience that it used to be, because people actually make it a point to go see them games now. So the tickets have gone up considerably in price. I think we paid like almost $40 a ticket for the game. Yeah, for the game last year. But I mean, the seats were amazing. I mean, the Lacombe, the stadiums in Florida are a lot bigger. I remember seeing like all the stadiums in Florida hold like somewhere between like 11 and 13,000, whereas the stadiums in Arizona are like 7 to 9,000.
Okay. Interesting.
Might flip that. I think it makes more sense, because Florida's more of a tourist attraction. But Yeah, I was when I went to the Tigers game a couple years ago, I wanted to go up to Dunedin and see the Blue Jays play, but I wasn't that happen. So please, if you get a chance, go see it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's such a cool experience, too, because during the regular season, you only got the 28 guys
yep.
they'll ever see, you know, up and down from the minors to the majors. But in spring training, it's the whole 40-man roster is all there, plus a handful of other guys that they eventually cut. But those guys get reps. Those guys get at-bats, and it's a chance to see some of your up-and-coming stars playing alongside of your current players and feeling out what the future of your team is, what your team could look like during the year. And the games don't really matter, but they're still fun to watch.
Yeah. And then you might
feels like a little taste of baseball before baseball, you know?
Yeah. And plus that's when they kind of do some of that minor leaguey stuff. Like if you remember, Will Ferrell played with multiple teams, I think like 10 teams in Arizona. Like he was just jumping around. Like at one point he sat in with Mike Trout in center field, or like replaced Mike Trout in center field.
Yeah. I remember him playing for the Dodgers for a second.
Yeah.
Or was it? Yeah.
You see Garth Brooks trying to shag grounders Chris Gaines, shag grounders for the Padres.
It's fun. And it's happening soon. I think games start next week, right?
The 24th. Yep.
Yeah. So 10 more days. The players have arrived. You're starting to see. Follow your teams on social media because you really get a taste of that. And I'm so excited for some Tigers baseball. Oh, I've gone fully. Football has left my consciousness post Super Bowl, and I am fully invested in baseball now.
Same. Can't wait. Cannot wait. And real quick before we go, I want to tell you, I told you, and I want to tell everybody else, I subscribe to the StatHead tool. It's $9 a month. I use it for a variety of things, for the podcast and for not the podcast, but they did something really awesome. They just sent emails. They sent me an email. They were like, hey, would you like to spend 30 minutes talking with one of our staff about anything about the StatHead tool? So I would like to thank Katie Sharp with StatHead for sitting down with me yesterday and spending 30 minutes talking baseball and walking me through the tool and giving me some really cool ideas for what I can use this tool for throughout the season, and I will definitely be taking advantage of it throughout the season. So if you've got the money and you love the sport and you'd want to mess around with it, I highly encourage you to check it out. Go to Baseball Reference or just Google StatHead baseball tool. And they do it for a lot of other sports too. They do it for like hockey, football, soccer, you name it. So go check that out.
And with that, that's going to do it for us here at Put Me in Coach. I want to thank you folks for listening. Please, if you'd be so kind, spread the word about us. Leave a review if you listen on iTunes or Spotify. There's also the Q&A. You know, feel free to participate. Just let us know you're listening and that we're doing this for folks out there. And let us know what you think. And otherwise, we're going to be back next week with a brand new episode and some more baseball to talk about. Some stuff is happening in the next week. And that's it. Goodbye.
Put Me in Coach is an Arctic Sounds original podcast hosted by Matt Coggins and Carl Mizell. Theme music is by Quack Quack Seatback. Edited and produced by Matt Coggins. Check out the footnotes of this episode to see links to all the great highlights, articles, and sources we mentioned on the podcast today, as well as the full theme song and ways to get in touch with us. For more, find us on Twitter and Instagram at PutMeInPod or at our website, putmeincoachpod.com.